All right, it's test time. You don't have to say anything out loud, but my shoe size, my favorite color, my favorite ice cream, my favorite band, my favorite composer, my favorite mountain bike trail, my favorite martial art. You know, there are a lot of things about people we just don't know. Matter of fact, I'm not sure my wife would have gotten all those correct. There are all kinds of details, but God knows every single detail about us. Now, for those of you who are curious, here we go. I'm sure you want to write all this down. My shoe size, 8.5. My favorite color is yellow. Of course, Chicken Man. My favorite ice cream, Bluebell, cherry vanilla. Yes. My favorite band, Third Day. My favorite composer, Tchaikovsky. My favorite mountain bike trail, the roller coasters on Haas Loop. And my favorite martial arts, Hapkido. I'm sure that just made your day to no end. But there are just a myriad of details about us that lots of people don't know, but God knows everything about us, every detail. And in Psalm 139, the Bible is going to address how much and how well God knows us. So if you turn to Psalm 139, and this knowledge of God in this psalm circles around four poles, four pins, four ideas about God knowing us. The first one is that God knows us in terms of depth. He knows us deeply and completely. Look at how the psalm begins. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in, behind and before, and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. You have searched me. It means like to dig around, like going through an old chest or an old box or an old crate, and you're digging around in there to stuff that hasn't been seen by anybody else or hasn't been seen at least in years. And so he says, God, you've dug around inside of me. You know all the things that nobody else knows, and you have known me. God doesn't just sort of know the stuff that others could know. God knows everything about us. He has dug around into all the hidden places that we have. And he's going to kind of lay out this knowing. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. God knows everything I've done. I mean, you realize that we can't even do this about ourselves. If I asked you to give me a blow-by-blow account of 3 weeks ago, you'd be in trouble. Matter of fact, most of us couldn't even handle 3 days ago, and some of you are trying to just figure out 3 minutes ago. He says, God knows every time I got up and every time I sat down and every single detail about every day that I have. And then he drops this statement at the end of verse 2, you discern my thoughts from afar. Now, what does that have to do with knowing me? Well, kids get this to an extent. If you ask a child, where is God? You're going to get one of two answers. Is he up there in heaven or he's here with us? Now, both of those are true. So what the psalmist is saying is it's astounding that God, who sits and reigns in heaven way up there afar, still knows every single detail about me way down here. Every speck, God knows all of it to the deepest of who I am. Matter of fact, look how he says it in verse 3. You search out my path and my lying down, and you are acquainted with all of my ways. You are every single step, God is with me. And then he says, here's how much God knows us, verse 4. Before you say it, God already knows what's going to come out your mouth. But even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. Now I want to make sure we grasp what this is saying. If you've been married a long time, sometimes you can finish each other's sentences. You know what the other one is going to say. However, even with that, they still will sometimes surprise you. So when it says that before a word is on my tongue, he's not saying that God's just been around us enough that he can make a pretty good guess as to what's going to be said next. He's not saying here that God is a really good educated guesser. What he's saying is God knows every single word you have ever said or will ever say before you have said any of them. Every one of them. Behold, O Lord, you know it all together. Here's how deeply God knows us. Because of this, He also protects us. The psalmist, after giving this description of God, knowing it, breaks out into a little bit of song here. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. You hem me in. It's a picture of like being inside of a fortress. And so you're in front of me and behind me. No matter where my enemy may attack, you have built a fortress around me to protect me. However, not every enemy attacks from the side or the front. Some of them actually attack from the air. So notice what he says. You've also laid your hand on me. So God protects me all the way around every side. Plus he protects me from the top. Put your hand upon me. And so because God knows me so well, he is always there to protect me. And then verse 6, he says, man, I just can't handle this. This is just unbelievable. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is beyond human comprehension. It is high, I cannot attain. It's like trying to attain to the top of a high pinnacle. I just can't reach it. It is too wonderful for me. Now, there are people who accomplish great things and we admire them. And we should admire them because they've done great things. And to me, the most admirable things that have been done are by people who never sought any recognition. Moms. But he's not saying here God has done some superhuman things that we admire him more than other people. God is not some elevated human being. He is God. See, admiring somebody is not worshiping them. We don't admire God like we admire people. We admire people, but we worship God. And so he says that this knowledge is beyond anything that I could even comprehend, that God knows every single thing about me. So here's what I want to do. I want to just take just a few seconds, and I want you to kind of make a quick list of some things about you that nobody knows. Okay, how many of y'all have come up with like at least three? Oh, you really think we're that impressed with you that we know that much about you? Come on, I'll give you a few more seconds now. Now have you come up and say, look, if I don't get some hands, I'm going to get a microphone. I'm going to start asking. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Nobody knows that you grab the hairbrush when your favorite song comes on and you dance in the bathroom in the morning. And thank you for that. Nobody knows you got some weird habit thing, like you have to put on your left sock before your right sock. Like nobody knows. Now, all of us have things like that that nobody knows, but God knows. Every single one of those details, nothing about us is hidden from him. God knows us with that kind of depth, down to the minutest of details about us. But not only does God know us deeply, but God also knows us broadly. Look at how he describes in verse 7. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where else shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness will cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. Now, when he says in verse 7, where can I flee from God? He's not saying that he's trying to get away from God. What he's saying is there's nowhere you can go that God is not present with you. This is meant as an encouragement for us. So God not only deeply down to the very details of me, but he also knows me broadly. Everywhere that I go, there's nowhere I can go where God is not there. And he's going to give three contrasts to show this. The first one's found in verse 8. If I ascend into heaven, you're there. And if I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. Now the word Sheol normally means grave. Matter of fact, the word Sheol means to ask. The reason is because the grave is always asking for more people. The grave is never satisfied. People are always dying. And so Sheol is always asking for more. But here in this context, probably the idea is not just the grave, but actually the idea of hell, because it's the opposite of heaven. So if I go to heaven, you are there. If I go all the way down to hell, you are there. In other words, people who hate God and want nothing to do with him still cannot escape him, even if they are in hell. And so he says, everywhere I go, heaven or hell. Then he gives a second contrast, the east and the west. If I take the wings of the morning, that's the east where the sun rises, and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, the Mediterranean was to their west. So we have the east and the west. Even there, your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me up. I cannot go up or down that you are not there. I cannot go east or west that you are not there. Well, how about this? Maybe you're there, but you can't see me. What does it say in verse 11? If I say, surely the darkness will cover me, and the light about me turns into night. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. Now, he's not saying here that God has some really fancy night vision goggles. Okay? God sees in the dark just like he sees in the light. You cannot hide anywhere that you go from God. Now, again, this is intended to be encouraging. God knows me to the depths of my being. God knows everywhere I go, he is always with me. That he knows me that well. He is always with me. So this is what I want you to do. I want you to grab your phone. Or if you already have it out, just take a pause from shooting bubbles and just pull up. So what I want you to do, take your phone. I want you to grab your notepad feature. Or right now, for the 4% of you that don't have a smartphone, because that's only 4% of Americans don't have a smartphone. 4% of you don't have a smartphone, you can get a pencil and paper. This is what I want you to do. I want you to type in two things that scare you. Heights, spiders, water, being alone. Please don't put mother-in-law. This shouldn't take long. You know what you're scared of. Now, beneath those two, this is what we put in. God is with me. God is with me. And the next time you're up high and you're scared, God is with me. The next time you see that creepy spider crawling across the floor, you remember, God is with me. And he's about to meet that God. When there are a round of layoffs at work, you think, God is with me. This is not intended to scare us. It is intended to encourage us. Wherever I go, God is with me. He knows me to the depths of my being. He knows me wherever I go. He knows me in depth and in breadth. But he also knows me because he made me. Verse 13, for you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you. You formed what are my inward parts? That's my inward parts, my organs, heart, liver, lungs, all those parts that make me up. That God, you have formed the inside of me. And then he takes a step further. He says, you have knitted me together in my mother's womb. You have woven me together. I am exactly the person that you designed. Listen, you are not the result of starting in the goo, coming through the zoo, and becoming you. You are a special creation by God. You've been knitted together. And notice that's in my mother's womb, a theme that he's going to run through here several times. Now, he breaks pattern here. The pattern has been, this is how God knows me, and then there's some praise for it. But instead, here in verse 14, he says, man, this is so good, I just got to drop a praise word in right here before I continue. So verse 14, he says, I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. What does it mean to be fearfully made? Here's the idea, that I'm made in a place where we should fear to tread. The womb is a special, holy, sacred place to our God, and nobody has any business messing around in there. I am fearfully, but not just fearfully, I'm also wonderfully made. We've seen this word wonderful already. Saw it back in verse 6, this knowledge is beyond anything that I can understand. That the workings of God to create a human being are beyond our comprehension. I am wonderfully made. And then he likes this word wonderful so much, he uses it again. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. I want to say it again. God is at work in the womb, creating and putting together and knitting and forming a very special person, and every single one of them is of value in the eyes of God. Now, verse 15, he gets down to some descriptions of how this happens. My frame was not hidden from you. What's my frame? That's my bones. It's my skeleton. That's what helps you stand up, to stay vertical. God knows your backbone, or lack thereof. He says, man, God knows my ribs, he knows my skull, he knows every single bone. God put together even the frame that I have. And he makes it again, this very important place in the womb when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth where people don't see the work of God happening. He says that the God is at work putting me together. And then he makes this incredible claim in verse 16. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. Before you were even conceived, God had already decided what you would look like, how tall you would be, color of your hair, the color of your eyes. He says that before your eyes saw my unformed substance, in your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me when as yet there were none of them. He says, God created me for a specific purpose. He sees it. He has declared it before they would even happen. So here's the idea. God decided that I would be born with hair and die without. You knew what I would look like. All of them were intricately written down. When God creates a life, it is something that is precious and sacred and serious. And something that goes beyond our comprehension. As a matter of fact, just the very nature of the way we work and operate and perform everything that we do is astounding. The intricacies of human beings is astounding. How God has woven us together. You understand how we go beyond comprehension if you're married. Some of you will get there in a little bit. So this is what he says in verse 17. This is what he's talking about. How intricate and complicated human beings are. Verse 17, how precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. All the details that go into making up a human being and to make us function, and not just function for a while, but to function for decades. All of this is astounding to us. The fact that you have a skeletal system that helps you stay upright. The fact that you have fluids in your inner ear to help you remain balanced. The fact that your eyes produce moisture to protect your eyes. I mean, all the little details of you. God has put all of those together beyond number and beyond count. Matter of fact, verse 18, if I would count them, they are more than the sand. You are not just a creation of God. You are a complex, intricate, amazing creation of God. And so he says that God knows me deeply, every detail. God knows me broadly everywhere I go. He says, and God has known me from the very beginning because God is the one who formed me. October 5th, today my life began. My parents do not know it yet. I am as small as the seed of an apple, but it is me already. I am to be a little girl. I will have black hair and blue eyes, but just about everything is settled. Even the fact that I will love flowers is already decided. 10 days later, October 15th, some say I'm not a real person yet, that only my mother exists, but I am real. Just as a small crumb of bread is still truly bread. My mother is and I am. 18 days later, October 23rd, my mouth is just beginning to open now. Just think, in a year or so, I'll be laughing, and later I think I know what my first word will be. Mom. 20 days later, October 25th, my heart began to beat today all by itself. From now on, it will gently beat for the rest of my life without ever stopping to rest. After many years, my heart will tire, and it will stop, and I will die. 31 days later, November 2nd, I'm growing a little every day now. My arms and legs are beginning to take shape, and I have to wait a long time before those little legs will raise me to my mother's arms, before these little arms will be able to gather flowers and hug my father. 38 days later, November 9th, tiny fingers are beginning to form on my hands. It's funny how small they are. I'll be able to stroke my mother's hair with these. 46 days later, November 17th, it wasn't until today the doctor told Mom that I'm living here under her heart. How very happy she must be. Are you happy, Mom? 51 days later, November 22nd, my mom and dad are probably thinking about a name for me now. They don't even know that I'm a little girl. I really hope they'll call me Kathy. I'm getting so big already. 66 days later, December 7th, my hair is growing. It's smooth and bright and shiny. What kind of hair do you have, Mom? 69 days later, December 10th, I'm just about able to see. It's dark around me. When Mom brings me into the world, it'll be full of sunshine and flowers. But what I want more than anything else is to see my mom. How do you look, Mom? 80 days later, December 21st, I wonder if Mom hears the whispering of my heart. Some children come into the world a little bit sick, but my heart is strong and healthy. It beats so evenly. You're going to have a healthy little girl, Mom. 84 days later, December 25th, today, my mother killed me. Abortion is murder. It is the taking of a human life, and it is wrong. Every single life is formed and fashioned and knitted together by God. And God takes them seriously and lovingly. We should take them seriously and lovingly. And to snuff out a life is wrong. It is murder. God knows me in depth. He knows me in breadth. He knows because he formed me, but he also knows the end. He also knows the judgment that's coming. Look at what this seems to change gears in verse 19, but it's still the same idea. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any grievous way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting. Now, here's the reason this is so significant. Not only does God know me in detail, not only does God know me everywhere I go, not only does God know me because he formed me, but God also, because of all that knowledge, will be able to pass correct judgment on me. See, if we pass judgment, there are always details we don't have. There's always information we're not aware of. We could even be deceived. But if witnesses are brought against us, they may lie, but God knows it. God knows the truth. So because God is all-knowing, there will never be a mistake when it comes to the judgment day, ever. So, oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. Murderers, depart from me, that God would judge them rightly and righteously. Not only are they murderers, but they are gossipers. They speak against you with malicious intent. They are your enemies. They take your name in vain. They may claim to belong to you, but they do not. They take it in emptiness. And now he makes this interesting statement. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them as my enemies. What does that mean? Here's what he's saying. God, I want to be where you are, and your enemies are my enemies. I am so identified with you. That's why he's saying verse 22, I hate them with complete hatred, and I count them my enemies. Look at what's happened. Because of their hatred, because of their murderous and slanderous ways, what have they done? They have created division. Love does not create division. Love brings us together. That's why as Christians, we should be uniters, not dividers. Because we've experienced the love of God and we want to share the love of God. But there are those who hate God and therefore hate those who belong to God and stand for the things of God. So, when it comes to the judgment, what do I want to happen to me? Verse 23, search me, O God, and know my heart. He goes back to like he did at the very beginning. Dig around to the very intimate details. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there be any grievous way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. He's not saying, look at me because I'm perfect. What he's saying is, God, I want you to cleanse me completely. You see, when we stand in the judgment day, God's going to pull up every single thing you've ever thought, everything you've ever done, everything you've ever said, every single one of them. And you are going to be found guilty, like bad guilty. So you only have one hope, and that is that you have been cleansed by God through his son, Jesus Christ. That is our hope. That is the only thing that, you know, it astounds me. When we think about the judgment, how many people don't take it seriously? It's like students who say, can I get an extension on the assignment? I didn't get it finished. Some things came up. Something got in the way. But it's week 9 of the semester. You've known for 9 weeks it was due. Well, yes, but I didn't get started on it until this week, which is already a stretch. We know you didn't start on it till last night. You know it's coming. You've been warned it's coming. Over and over again you've been warned. And yet, you're still not ready. You're still not prepared. Listen, the judgment is coming. Do not put off getting ready. Make sure that you are right with God when you stand in the judgment. And the only way to be right with God is through his son, Jesus Christ. God knows you from the beginning. He knows you in your depth. He knows you in your breadth. And he knows what's going to happen in the end. He knows every detail so he can rightly and righteously judge you. The only hope that we have in the judgment is that we come out in the way of everlasting. And that only comes through his son, Jesus Christ. So what does that mean? What does that look like to be right with God through his son, Jesus? I didn't care a whole lot for school. I hated school. I went all the way through high school and never took a book home. I never did homework. I wasn't going to school. And so I graduated and I was working. And then I really sensed that God was calling me into the ministry. I was already engaged by that point. I went to my pastor and I said, I think God's calling me in the ministry. What do I do? And he said, well, you need to go to college and seminary. I said, no, we're doing the non-educational path. He said, no, you really need to go to college and seminary. I said, oh, man. So because Jerry was already in college, we were going to be getting married. And I'm like, well, I'm going to have to hurry because if I want to graduate with her, I'm going to have to do it in 3 years. And so I thought, well, maybe I can get a kind of head start here. And so I looked at the schedule and was able to take a few classes at the local community college to kind of give me a running start so that I could, you know, take extra hours in college and graduate with her. And so I signed up. Now, I had this idea that I was going to be an aeronautical engineer. Those are the kind of classes I like. So I did like physics and astronomy and stuff. Then I thought, you know what? If I'm going to be a pastor, a speech class might be a good thing to take. And so I enrolled in a speech class. Now, picture again, it's a secular school, not a religious school, it's a secular school. I'm taking a speech class, and you have all the speeches you would expect, speech to inform, and you have a speech to demonstrate, and all that other kind of stuff. But near the end of the semester, there's always the speech to persuade. So I selected as my topic for my speech to persuade that Roe v. Wade should be overturned and that unborn life should be protected legally in our country. And so I made my speech and I gave some facts and things, but also tried to speak to the emotions because lots of people can't think logically or consistently. And so you just got to try to sway them. This is a speech to persuade. And so I tried to, you know, go for both mind and the heart. Here's the interesting thing, that once you were done with this speech, the professor will allow one or two people, if they would like, to ask a question or offer a rebuttal. So when I was done, there was a girl raised her hand, and I mean, she lit into me. I mean, it was nasty and it was ugly and verbally assaulted me. That was in the days when we had people who were tough in America, so I just kind of let it roll off. Didn't run to my safe space or any other kind of ridiculousness. I just, you know, just took it like you did. And so that was fine. And a couple days later, I saw her in the hallway. She said, could I talk to you for a second? I thought, well, here we go, round two. She said, I just want you to know, I don't agree with abortion, but I think they should be legal for people who need to have them. That's the typical illogical, inconsistent thinking of our world, and you still hear that kind of baloney today. I knew what was going on. This had nothing to do with what she thought or rationally considered in terms of legal issues. This was very personal for her. It was obvious. So I just looked at her and I said, look, I just want to say something. I am a Christian. I take the Bible seriously. Because of that, abortion is murder. And you killed your unborn child. But I want you to know that my Jesus will forgive you. Listen, this is our message. This is what it means to be a Christian. We don't have it all together. We don't live crystal clear and clean lives. We're filthy, dirty, ugly sinners who have been forgiven by Jesus Christ. And the message I gave to her that day is the same message I've given to thousands of people in over 3 decades since then. If you're thinking about doing something wrong, don't do it. Don't do it. But if you are here and you have done it, Jesus will forgive you. He will forgive you. If you have had an abortion, Jesus will forgive you. If you have committed adultery, what you did was wrong, but Jesus will forgive you. If you have stolen pins from work, if you have stolen, what you did was wrong, but my Jesus will forgive you. If you have slandered people and gossiped about people, what you did was wrong, but my Jesus will forgive you. If you have been envious and jealous of other people, what you have done is wrong, but my Jesus will forgive you. If you're thinking about doing something that violates God's law, don't. Don't do it. Don't do it. But if you have, I want to tell you that Jesus, through his death on the cross and his resurrection, will forgive you completely. We are a fellowship not of the perfect. We're a fellowship of the forgiven. And so we do not waver on what is wrong. When God calls it wrong, we call it wrong. But neither do we waver on forgiveness. I don't care how ugly a thing you have done, Jesus will forgive you.